This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. There are allegations people with disability are being lured into moving into share houses operated by unscrupulous National Disability Insurance Scheme providers. Workers have told a Four Corners investigation there are dozens of examples of this, and they claim it's being done so that the providers can take clients' NDIS funding. But the NDIS regulator says it's not its place to know where they've been taken, as Jessica Longbottom reports.
As she drives through one of Melbourne's outer suburbs, community nurse Linda Carafilli points out the house where her client was taken to live.
When you trick someone to go somewhere and you get them there and their feeling is that they actually cannot leave, to my mind that's abduction. To my mind that's being kept against your will.
She says that in 2021 the man was promised better food and 24-hour care if he left his boarding house and switched to a new NDIS provider.
I remember receiving a call from him absolutely desperate saying, I'm stuck out here, I'm not even sure exactly where this suburb is or how I've ended up here. I'm scared to leave. I'm going to be homeless.
In Victoria, 4,000 people live in boarding houses known as supported residential services. 1,600 of them are on the NDIS and have combined packages worth $200 million. Charlotte Jones, who's the CEO of the Mental Health Legal Centre, says it makes them a valuable target.
You'll have somebody walking in saying, well, I have this house in this place and you can come and live there and we'll give you pizza every night and there'll be a flat screen TV and all of these other things to entice them to come with them.
They then charge the NDIS for services to residents, even if they're not delivered. Anyone can become a provider and they don't have to be registered with the regulator. The NDIS Quality and Safeguards Commissioner, Tracy Mackey, says it's inappropriate for the commission to know where everyone on the scheme lives.
We're not keeping tabs on their individual decision making of where someone might choose to live. That is absolutely part of their right. And in fact, at the forefront of what we do at the Commission is the rights of people with disability, making sure that we uphold and respect those rights.
Jamie Colhane used to live with 16 others at one of these supported residential services at Sydenham Grace in Melbourne's West. He has schizophrenia and bipolar disorder.
It was like living in a hellhole, that place. The layout is like cells, one cell after another, all the way down the hallway. There was a big padlock on the door with a chain, so thick, massive, like you're locked in, like you're in prison.
The SRS was closed last year after the Victorian government found it was uninhabitable and that people were subject to intimidation. The boarding house wasn't an NDIS facility, but the owners also had two NDIS businesses. They signed up Jamie and other residents as NDIS clients.
That's what they're all about, is money. Wherever they can get it, they'll grab it. Yep.
One of the co-owners of Sydenham Grace and the NDIS companies told Four Corners she disagrees, and the companies went above and beyond to provide services to the clients. Jamie is now living with his brother and says he has a support worker who's giving him great care.
That report from Jessica Longbottom and Anne Connolly, and you can see the Four Corners investigation 8:30 tonight on ABC TV or on ABC's iView. Boosting the number of people with skills to fill jobs in clean energy, aged care and the digital economy is one of the goals of the federal government's new employment strategy being released today. It includes a shake-up of the TAFE system so that people can get the chance to obtain bachelor-level qualifications for these sectors without having to go to university. The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, joined me earlier to discuss it. Treasurer, you're releasing this white paper today. What will the measure of success be, say, in 12 months and 5 years?
Well, good morning, Sabra. It's a really important day today. We released this employment white paper, which is the culmination of about 12 months of collaboration and consultation after the Jobs and Skills Summit around this time last year. And the measure of success will be whether we can build together a more dynamic, a more inclusive labour market where more people have the opportunity for secure, fairly paid work and where our people and businesses and communities can be beneficiaries of change and thrive and succeed. And so we measure that, obviously, by all of the ways we measure the labour market, unemployment, underutilisation, underemployment, youth unemployment, all of those really really important things. We start from a pretty strong position, but we want to really set people up for the future, and that's what this is all about.
The government is aiming to double higher apprenticeship commencements in priority areas identified in the white paper over 5 years. How will you do that, given some of the priority areas are historically low-paid jobs that struggle to get staff?
Well, first of all, whether it's, for example, areas like aged care, which has been underpaid for too long. You know, we've made a multi-billion dollar investment into making the wages in aged care fairer to properly recognise the important work that people do. But on your broader point, you know, we broadly know how our economy and how our society is changing. We know from the Intergenerational Report that we will need more care and support workers, that we'll need more workers in the net zero economy. We need our workers to be better able to adapt and adopt technology. And so we know where our economy's headed and where our country is headed, and we need to make sure that we can train people to grab those opportunities, and so that employers can find the people that they need when they need them. So this, a new announcement today, turbocharging the TAFE Centres of Excellence and accelerating those higher apprenticeships, is all about finding the workers that we need for the economy of the future.
Just on those new centres of excellence, the government will fund six of them. What exactly will they specialise in, and who will decide where they go?
Well, this is on top of a $325 million investment that we've put forward under the skills agreement for TAFE Centres of Excellence. And what the new money is all about is recognising that the big opportunities will be in those areas that I mentioned, whether it's care and support, net zero, adapting, adopting technology. And so the money is to turbocharge those TAFE centres of excellence to really focus on where the big job-creating opportunities will be. And as part of that as well, developing further these higher and degree apprenticeships, which recognise that more and more people, in order to grab the jobs that our economy will create in the years and decades ahead, they need to finish school, they need to do an additional qualification too. So whether it's the skills passport or what we're doing in TAFE, what we're doing to make sure that the different parts of the education system talk to each other and deliver for workers and employers at the same time, all of this is a really important path forward.
Just on those centres of excellence again, who will decide where they go?
Well, we work closely with the states, but one of the real secrets, I think, to what we're proposing here, one of the secrets to what I think will be the success of these centres of excellence, is they are a genuine partnership between TAFEs, Jobs and Skills Councils, industry and universities to work together to work out where these centres of excellence go, work out the curriculum so that we can give students, future workers, the cutting edge skills that they need. But really what you'll see in the employment white paper is amongst these five themes, whether it's full employment, job security and wages, productivity growth, skills needs and overcoming barriers to employment, is a real way to try and find where there's the common ground between employers and workers and the education system and governments at all levels. We've all got an interest in a more productive, competitive and innovative economy. We've all got an interest in creating opportunities and making sure that people can grasp those opportunities in more parts of Australia. And you'll be hearing a lot more about that today.
When it comes to productivity, the impacts of schooling from home during the pandemic and the increase in so-called school refusals must worry you. Surely that will have an impact on the future workforce. Shouldn't that be part of the Commonwealth's COVID inquiry?
Well, the COVID inquiry will give us the opportunity to learn from all of those things in the past as it relates to Commonwealth policy and to do things better in the future.
Including these things?
Well, we take responsibility for the education system broadly. And obviously, we want to know what we learned from COVID and how we can do things better in the future. And there's nothing in the way that this review has been set up to prevent the states participating or to prevent us looking at some of these sorts of things as it relates to Commonwealth policy.
On a separate issue, the Nine newspapers have got access to encrypted messages allegedly written by the Secretary of the Home Affairs Department, Mike Pezzullo, where he's tried to influence and manipulate the political process and criticise coalition figures. How comfortable are you with that behaviour from a senior public servant?
Well, first of all, I mean, I only saw those stories last night. And as I understand it, Minister Claire O'Neill has referred these issues to the Public Service Commissioner. He will advise her on this matter. And in advance of that, you know, I'm reluctant to kind of get into it.
Jim Chalmers, thanks for talking to AM this morning.
Appreciate it, Sabra. All the best.
Jim Chalmers is the Federal Treasurer. Supply chains and aerial firefighting support are just two topics up for discussion at a disaster preparedness summit in Canberra today. Apart from fire authorities and state governments, there'll also be representatives from major supermarkets, banks and the transport sector to plan how everyone can work together of what could be a busy bushfire season. Fatima Alumi reports.
When we think of getting ready for bushfires or other disasters, equipment and emergency personnel might spring to mind. But the federal government's keen to make sure energy, transport and other sectors are also involved in the planning. Tanya Barden is the CEO of the Australian Food and Grocery Council.
Any adverse weather event, whether it's flooding or fire, can put enormous strain on communities, and sometimes you'll get those broken lines of being able to get goods, particularly into some of the remote and regional communities. And then with supply chains, you can sometimes get some breakages where you're not able to get the produce to market or the produce itself may be affected by the weather conditions.
While the pressures from the COVID pandemic and other fires and floods have eased, she says planning is the key to curbing future disruptions.
I think the main thing for us is thinking longer term rather than just about this summer. And we need to make sure that we have policies in place that support a strong food and grocery manufacturing industry. We also need to make sure that governments are providing support to organisations like Food Bank to help people when they're in that crisis situation.
And she's optimistic that industry can respond quickly to help areas hit by disasters.
Australia has a very networked transport system, a very networked food and grocery manufacturing system, a lot of diversity in it. And where there are disruptions, they tend to be short-term in nature.
The Federal Minister for Emergency Management, Murray Watt, is confident the nation is bushfire ready, although he concedes some eastern parts of the country haven't been able to do all the planned hazard reduction.
I've been in rural Victoria myself a couple of months ago speaking to volunteer firefighters who were saying that when they were trying to do hazard reduction burns, their boots were just sinking in the mud. It was still so wet. So that has made it difficult in some parts of the country.
Another concern is aerial firefighting support. Last week, the New South Wales Rural Fire Service Commissioner Rob Rogers renewed calls for a national aerial firefighting fleet. Senator Watt says it's something the federal government's working on.
We now have one more large water bombing plane at the national level, and a couple of the states have also acquired their own heavy water tanker planes as well. But in addition, we'll have more large helicopters available this year for water bombing than we have in the past. So all up, we're looking at about 500 aircraft, which means that we've got actually more aircraft available for firefighting than we've ever had before.
The bushfire summit will continue tomorrow.
Fatima Alumi with that report. At the start of the year, the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese received a warm welcome in Papua New Guinea as he promised the two countries would develop a bilateral security treaty. That agreement is supposed to clarify the future of joint security efforts like the redevelopment of the Lombrum naval base on Manus Island. But as PNG correspondent Tim Swanston reports, the mid-year deadline's passed and negotiations are still dragging on.
Amid the rain and tropical heat of Manus Island, Australian and Papua New Guinean defence engineers are constructing a school at the Lombrum Naval Base. It's part of the long-running annual exercise Puk Puk. Here's ADF Captain Helena Soriel.
The best thing about it is you're working with the PNGDF in their country, experiencing their culture, and you're doing real-time tasks.
The Lombrum Naval Base looks very different to a few years ago when it was home to an Australian Immigration Detention Centre. Australia and PNG are now hoping the joint redevelopment of the operational quarters of the base will help facilitate better cooperation between the two countries. Here's ADF Lieutenant Nick Trotter.
It's all good to have an agreement between nations at that national security level, but unless you've also got the people-to-people links and you understand each other genuinely, then it doesn't work as well.
The base's commanding officer, Boonie Doria, agrees.
It's like bringing us together, building that relationship, making it more firm and strong, you know.
Australia's Defence Cooperation Program with PNG is the largest it has with any country. Recognising the need to create a legal framework for current and future activities in the region, like at the Lombrum base, a bilateral security treaty was announced earlier this year. Negotiations were meant to be finished by May, but it hasn't proven easy. In June, PNG's Prime Minister James Marape said he felt the proposed wording of the document encroached on the country's sovereignty. Yesterday, he said it's important the treaty is legally sound.
We have a national constitution and our country's laws to comply with. So ensuring that the treaty that we will sign is legally compliant on our side as well as it's legally compliant on their side.
It was hoped the security treaty would be finalised before Saturday's annual Prime Minister's 13 rugby league clash, but it wasn't, and neither PM was there. Instead, the Minister for International Development and the Pacific, Pat Conroy, was representing Australia. He told the ABC he believes there are just a few issues to still sort out.
We're hoping to conclude negotiations shortly, but I'm not going to put a specific month on it. The important thing is to get it right. To get an agreement that supports the security and sovereignty of both nations, and I'm confident we'll get there.
This is Tim Swanston in Manus Province reporting for AM.
Scientists are celebrating the safe landing of the largest soil sample collected from an asteroid. NASA's space capsule this morning landed in the US state of Utah, carrying rocks from the asteroid Bennu. It marks the end of a 7-year-long mission, which it's hoped will shed light on the birth of the solar system and the creation of life on Earth. Flint Duxfield reports.
Touchdown. I repeat, EDL, FRC has touchdown.
With a puff of dust, a brown and white capsule that spent the last 7 years swooping through the solar system touched down gently in the desert west of Salt Lake City, Utah.
A journey of a billion miles has come to an end, marking America's first sample return mission of its kind and opening a time capsule to our ancient solar system.
Its payload, just 200 grams of asteroid soil collected during the 7-year OSIRIS-REx mission to the asteroid Bennu. It's only the third asteroid sample returned to Earth for analysis, after two similar missions by Japan's space agency, which gathered about a teaspoon of material. ANU astrophysicist Dr. Brad Tucker says the sample could provide an important portal to examine what the universe looked like billions of years ago.
The asteroids haven't changed a lot in the 4.5 billion years since they've been formed. For 3.5-4 billion years, they've been just essentially a frozen chunk of rock out there. What this means is the ingredients that went into our solar system are, for the most part, almost frozen in time on these things.
Dr. Tucker says one theory is that small worlds like Bennu once seeded Earth with the prebiotic ingredients needed to form life.
Some people theorize that an asteroid or a comet crashed onto the Earth with these ingredients and kind of gave it the spark of life. And so if amino acids and organic compounds and those things that are the key ingredients for the building blocks of life were on asteroids that regularly cross the Earth and they were there 4 billion years ago, that maybe is exactly how life started.
While the asteroid may provide clues as to the origins of life, it could also pose a threat to Earth's very existence. Asteroids like Bennu are known as near-Earth asteroids, which Dr. Tucker says do pose a risk of one day colliding with Earth with potentially catastrophic consequences.
Bennu is one of them that we do know regularly crosses our path and has in a couple of hundred years a few times where it gets relatively close to the Earth. So studying the composition of these things, what they're made up of, and potentially in the future how to defend them, like the DART mission last year, is a really important aspect.
Scientists are expecting the details of what was found on the asteroid to be revealed in the next 6 to 12 months.
Flint Duxfield reporting. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. If you've been to fill up your car recently, it's a rather unpleasant experience, with petrol prices now well above the $2 mark. Today, business reporter Nassim Kadem on the forces behind the price hikes and why petrol prices won't be coming down anytime soon. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.